May what we have been taught this week through your Spirit now come to fruition in the way we think and the way we value each other and the nation. And may the Spirit continue to bless our efforts with the gifts of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. We place this before you, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever. Amen. I thank you for opening up your schedules, and I welcome you here this evening, and also to extend again a warm welcome to those who are watching this evening on air. It's not Airstream, it's live stream. And by this time, I think we're all familiar with the importance of technology and Zoom meetings and everything else. Over at the Friary, where I live here in Denver, there are nine of us, if everybody is at home. And way in the beginning of the COVID pandemic, we decided to offer a live-streamed Mass at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning. And it's amazing because I think on Easter Sunday, we had over 2,500 people from around the world, including the Vatican, if you can believe that. They were probably checking on my homily to see if there was any heresy in the homily, but it's amazing because there's so much of an effort being made to not lose touch with each other and not lose touch with the Church and her sacramental life. And we will continue that live stream Mass until the epidemic, so to speak, is declared finished. And certainly, I know you have your own Masses and so forth here, but you're more than welcome to tap into that. It's very simple. It's Capuchins with the plural, capuchins.org, and it will direct you to all of the websites and so forth that are attached to the community. We also have provided something each morning called Good Morning, Good People, which was the way that St. Francis opened all of his little talks and conferences to people back in the 12th century. And each one of us down through these months of the COVID pandemic have taken a few minutes to say something on this little program. And as far as I'm aware, that's all recorded on YouTube and everything else. So I'm glad that the folks are joining us each evening on live stream. And I find it very difficult to say that this is Thursday and the mission is over tonight. I don't know whether your experience is the same as my own, but it seems that these weeks go by very, very quickly, and suddenly it's Thursday, it's the final night. And I've enjoyed myself very much being with you and with your priests this week, so I kind of hate to go home. I won't tell the guys at home that. But as you know, if you've been able to join me evening by evening, these parish missions always deal with an overall topic. And I have chosen this time around, and this is our third time together, to look at this call to live a virtuous life, a life that is marked by kindness and honesty and decency, and all of those things that lubricate our human interaction and make it possible for us to coexist. It's not just to be found in the richness of our own Judeo-Christian tradition, this call to a virtuous way of life, because we even find this among the ancient pagan authors, someone like Aristotle, whom I've mentioned each evening. He has this book called the Nicomachean Ethics, and he lays out a kind of ethic of behavior, an ethic of thinking, an ethic of interpersonal interaction, and helps us to understand that this is not just a Judeo-Christian concept, this is a universal human concept, and that therefore we want to take into consideration these seven or eight virtues that we have looked at this week. Certainly not an exhaustive list, but to see how important these are, and to know that they're not abstractions and pieces of theory, and that this has not been esoteric and pedantic as if it's purely academic, but that how do we live these virtues? How do we learn these virtues? And what does it mean to practice these virtues? All of that takes me to the final topic here this evening, and that is for us to look at the two pillars, the two foundations upon which this virtuous life is lived, and that is the two institutions of marriage and family life. These are the two schools where, as youngsters growing up, we learn by watching our parents and the other adults in our world as kids, and how they behave, and how they speak to one another, and how they treat each other with respect and honor and esteem. Kids, as I think you've heard me say, they don't learn necessarily by teachers. They learn by witness, and they learn by example. And it's therefore in these two institutions of marriage and family life that we create this kind of virtuous school, where even from the youngest years of their lives, they can watch us and know the way they're supposed to behave in the journey of their life, so that their interaction with other people is marked by these virtues of civility and learning, all those mercy and we looked at eight virtues together this week, and this evening I want to spend our time looking at marriage and family life. And as I said earlier in the week, maybe somebody would say, well, you know, you're a priest and you're not married, so your insights are limited, and you don't have kids, and therefore your insights are very limited. But if I need to justify myself, at least as a priest, I can tell you that most priests spend a great deal of their life dealing with married couples, and that certainly has been the case with me, even from the time that I was in the seminary. When I was in Washington studying years and years ago, before I was ordained, there was a beautiful little program called the Teams of Our Lady, which was brought into Washington from France, and it was gathering maybe 8 to 10 married couples together once a month and going through a kind of manual, developing with them a spirituality that was unique to the married state. And I was involved with 3 or 4 of these little groups, as were a lot of the other friars in the house, and it certainly wasn't a one-way street. It was reciprocity. As I shared some insights, I learned from these married couples 10 times more than I ever gave. And that little organization called the Teams of Our Ladies, I don't even know whether that's still operating, but it was very popular. And I had an older couple who were great friends of mine, and I said to the gentleman, he was a veteran of the Vietnam War, he was in the Air Force, and he had 5 tours of duty, and when he came home, I suggested that he and his wife might join the Teams of Our Lady, and he said to me, who do they play? I said, no, George, it's a religious organization. And the joke at Capuchin College when I was a student was to say if Simeon Gallagher ever left the priesthood, he'd have to leave with a married couple, because of the amount of time that I spent and learned so much. And I also, all of my life as a priest, have been a teacher. This ministry of preaching that I have been involved in for the last 33 years is itself a form of teaching. But I taught youngsters in a Catholic grade school for a number of years while I was in the seminary in Washington, D.C. When I was ordained, they sent me to Western Kansas, where I was on the faculty of both a boys' school and a girls' high school. And also I was a teacher at Marymount College in Salina, Kansas. And then they transferred me into Kansas City, and I was a co-pastor in a large suburban parish. And a father came to me one time, and he was very concerned about his two teenage daughters who were sophomores, I think maybe even freshmen, in this high school where there was a lot of drug activity. And he said to me, "I'm very concerned. Can you make any suggestion?" I said, "Well, there's a wonderful Catholic high school across town run by French nuns." And I said, "It's pricey, and therefore, if the kids get in, it's going to cost you a little bit of money." He said, "I don't care what it costs. I don't want these two daughters of mine to get caught in a drug-addicted world." So I said, "Well, let me talk with the principal." Now, if you've ever dealt with nuns, I loved them to death. I had three aunts who were nuns, but nuns, you can get blood from a stone. At least they can. And I went across town and sat down with the principal of this high school and shared with her the concern of her father. And I said, would there be room in this school for these two girls? And she said, "Oh, Father, there's no problem at all. We will accept them tomorrow morning." But, and she blackmailed me. She said, "We'll take the girls into the school, but you have to become a teacher." I said, "Sister, I'm the pastor of a large parish. I've finished my academic work at the university. I've got more than enough stuff." She said, "Well, if you want the girls to get in." So I became a teacher. So I'm just mentioning all of this because my life has been spent in education, at the youngest levels with little kids and with college kids, and now here I am with adults in this world of preaching ministry. So I think, I'm no expert, but I think that any priest, if he is a thinking individual and listens to people in their lives, he has insights to share, and hopefully the insights that he shares are encouragement and lifting up people, particularly in marriage and family life. So for the first beginning little bit of information or sharing tonight, let me look with you at this issue of marriage. I would like to frame this to begin with this evening because there's two different levels of this issue of marriage. One of the predominant, one of the consistent dimensions of our human journey is the experience of loneliness. Loneliness. God said to Adam, "Because I don't want you to be lonely, I will give you a spouse. I will give you a life mate." And that loneliness that is part of the human journey, it's always going to be there. And it will never, ever leave. And in my travels, particularly around the country, when I have an opportunity to read these alternative newspapers and all of these personals that are always in the back pages of these alternative newspapers, there are columns upon columns of people trying, so to speak, to offer themselves to some imaginary mythic life mate. And when you look at these things, these ads, these personals, it's just one statement after another of loneliness, loneliness, loneliness. It's a constitutive dimension of our humanity. This culture that you and I are a part of tonight would say to us the worst thing in the world is to end up being lonely. But you never shake it. The trick is to take this experience of loneliness and turn it into solitude, turn it into times alone that are rich and deep, where we become engaged with good reading. We develop adult tastes in music. We watch informative programming on television, and we watch beautiful films, so that this loneliness turns into solitude and it becomes a teachable moment for deepening us and making the journey that we are on more meaningful and more directed. We never shake loneliness. I have an older brother. I think I've mentioned him a time or two this week. He's a few years older than I am, and he's 6'7", maybe even 6'8". He played professional basketball when he was a young man with the ABA, and then that was folded into the NBA. And he ended up coaching first with the 76ers in Philadelphia and then with the Boston Celtics. He was on the advanced team of the Munich Olympics for the American team. His resume reads very well, and he is the total jock of the universe, as you can imagine, with all of that athletic background. I am not in the least bit athletic. I tried my hand at some sports, but he is superior to me all over the place. And he is the older brother, and he always says to me, the beginning of every conversation with my brother is this statement: the problem with you. And he completes that by saying, the problem with you is that you think entirely too much about everything. And of course, I'm the younger brother, and I have to have a retort, as brothers always have to have a retort. And I say to him, and the problem with you is that you don't think about anything. But oddly enough, I know he does think, because several years ago, he said to me, listen to this. He said, why is it that I can be in the midst of a family celebration? Maybe it's Thanksgiving, maybe one of the kids is celebrating a birthday, and everybody is gathered around that dinner table. The people that are there are the people that I love more than anyone else in the world. And I think he said they love me. Why is it in that kind of a situation that is absolutely saturated with companionship and love? Why is it in those situations do I often also feel a wave of loneliness washing over me? I don't think my brother is the only person that's ever had that experience. We can find ourselves in the most intimate moments of sharing and so forth with another person, and then feel this wave of loneliness washing through. I think it's because that's the way that God has created us. And when he raised the question, I said to him, Joe, God has blessed you with a good marriage. He has blessed you with a happy family life. But there is a part of you that Sharon and the kids will never touch. There is a part of you that only God can fill. And that is why St. Augustine made the famous statement, and I'm sure that many listening to my voice tonight can complete the statement, is to be found in Augustine's autobiography, The Confessions of Augustine. He said, "Our hearts are restless, O God, until they rest in you." There is no sense of complete and utter fulfillment and completion in the journey of our life that we can give to one another. It's only God that can ultimately fulfill us. And because that loneliness is so present in our human journey, I think that marriage as an arrangement, marriage as a statement of love, marriage as a public proclamation that I have found someone who, yes, is struggling with his or her own loneliness, and that God, even for people who don't believe in God, we find the reality of marriage. Friars from my province here in Denver, we were asked by the Vatican way back in the 1950s to go into the southern highlands of Papua New Guinea and begin to develop programs in evangelization, programs, a mission to these folks. We could never go anywhere where the Australian government had not gone ahead of us, because many of these people were cannibals. They were living in a Stone Age culture. They had never seen anything shiny like hammers and nails. And when the friars went in there to begin to build the mission and to build houses to live in, the natives were absolutely fascinated by the shininess of the hammers and the nails, and the friars had to make sure that they were locked securely at the end of the day, because the natives were trying to get them to bang the nails into each other's heads as a kind of physical decoration. And yet, in the midst of all of that, when the friars went in to this Stone Age culture, what did they find? The institution of marriage. They found rituals in which two people who had fallen in love with each other, even in that primitive culture, wanted to make a statement to the world, wanted everyone to know about that love. Even in the most primitive societies, you find the reality of this institution of marriage. And this is not for only people who believe in God. These people had never heard of the Christian God. And yet here we find commitment. Here we find tenderness and love of one person for the other. Here we find them belonging to each other and making a public statement of that love, so that all the other people in the villages would know, you keep your hands off of this person, because this person belongs to me and I belong to that person. I think that this institution of marriage has come to be a reality because we search for people to break open our loneliness and to share that loneliness, so that we are not on the journey alone, but that we are on the journey with another person. And we lift each other up and we help each other out. This is purely the institution of marriage. That's the first level I would want us to recall tonight. And then there is a second level. And that is the level of the Judeo-Christian tradition. That is to say that God has taken this human institution that we find even in primitive societies, and he has elevated this and raised this institution and turned it into a sacrament And in the old Baltimore Catechism that many of us learn from, one of the questions and answers, what is a sacrament? And the answer was, a sacrament is an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. In other words, the elevation of the institution of marriage into a sacramental statement, that this is a sign to the rest of the world that the love between this man and this woman is a statement of God's consistent and eternal love for the human community. It is an outward sign of an interior reality, and the interior reality is that this married couple, this man and this woman, it's a sign to the world God's enduring and ever-present love. And in a sacramental marriage, as different from a civil marriage or a same-sex marriage or whatever the arrangement might be, in a sacramental marriage, it is always a man and a woman because of the complementarity, if nothing else, their physical beings, that God has created the woman's body and the man's body to fit together, and that the fruit of their being together is a child that is to be born. I am not making any statement about any of the other forms of marriage, but the other forms of marriage recognized, for example, by the Supreme Court in same-sex marriages, these are not sacramental marriages. And therefore, they're not a threat to a sacramental marriage. They don't cheapen a sacramental marriage. There's just another way that people can come, people who have no God to believe in, or people that have a God, but they have things going on in their life that do not make it possible for them to enter into a sacramental marriage. It's a man and a woman, and that marriage has been elevated away from just being a civil institution and a public arrangement, and now it becomes a statement of God's love through the love of the man and the love of the woman for each other. It is a statement. So marriage is a sacred reality. It is a manifestation. It is a presentation. It is an epiphany of God's enduring, consistent, and never-ending love. A married couple, for those of us who are not married, like myself, we should be able to see in the love of a husband and a wife for each other the encouragement and the manifestation of God's own love presenting itself in the love of the husband and the wife. So this is a beautiful, moving, tender, and sacred reality. And I want, as a priest, dealing now, as you heard me say, come August, I will be a priest for 50 years, my golden jubilee. I don't know how many married couples have passed through those 50 years. I don't remember the number of couples that I have married, especially when I was in university work. But I have come to acknowledge, recognize, that marriages that are going to work, marriages that have solidity, sacramental marriages of a man and a woman, that there are four characteristics that you will always find in these kinds of solid marriages. And I want to run these past you tonight and then make a few comments before we finish from my experience as a teacher, observations about raising kids, which I would like to share with you as well, and it will be done for the night. But the first of these four pillars, so to speak, or four characteristics, the first of these is mutual trust and loyalty. Especially when this couple is out in a public arena, I don't know how many times as a priest we are invited to all kinds of parties. And let's just imagine a Super Bowl party. You go to the Super Bowl party, and all the men are in the front room with the television on, watching the game. And one of them, and there's always this reality in my observation, there's one of them who, for the sake of being humorous, is using his wife to kick her around in terms of mocking the way she cooks, mocking the way she doesn't keep the house, using his wife to humor the other football meatheads that are in the room with them. Using the wife in a public setting, not to honor her and to be loyal to her, but to cheapen her and make fun of her. I listen to this in the front room with all the guys that are watching the television, and then I go into the kitchen where all the women are gathered, and there's always one woman, and she's usually the wife of the meathead in the front room, and she's using her husband to titillate the other ladies. He doesn't pick up after himself. He doesn't know how to wash or dry the clothes, and the husband becomes the object, a humorous object of disregard. This is, you never will find this in a solid marriage, because there's always mutual trust and there's loyalty. If these are the issues in a marriage, they are to be resolved with the couple and not to be announced and proclaimed so that they cheapen the other spouse. And yet, unfortunately, that too frequently goes on. Mutual respect and loyalty, and this is particularly important when these marriages encounter, down through the years, struggles and difficulties. Like, for example, from a woman's point of view, I can only use the word, certainly I've never had the experience, but when women go through menopause, it's a hormonal experience in their life that often creates tension and friction, etc., in the marriage. But what many people do not understand and appreciate is that men go through their own form of menopause. This was brought to the attention 40 years ago in a very famous book written by a Yale professor, a woman by the name of Gail Sheehy, and you can still read this book. It's called The Seasons of a Man's Life. And she schematized, analyzed what men go through at a certain point in their life. And this is not age determined. It can happen to a young guy as well as an older gentleman. And with men, it is not hormonal, it is psychological, that men arrive at a point where they feel that they are losing their virility. They feel that they might not be handing anything of value onto their children, that they are not growing and deepening the human journey that they are on. Men go through a psychological interior, they call it menopause. And it is extremely painful. Why? Because men in this culture are never, ever supposed to show any kind of vulnerability. It's not the manly thing to do, to have struggles going on in your life. And here is this guy going through the tortures of the damned on the inner landscape of his life, and he has no one to talk to, because a man is not supposed to talk about these things. And when these kinds of realities begin to happen, whether it's female menopause or male menopause, this is one of the most crucial times in a marriage where they will be loyal to each other. And I want to bring that to your attention, because this menopause experience, it is usually precipitated by a significant loss in the man's life. I was in a parish in upstate New York a number of years ago, and one of the women in the parish made an appointment to come in and speak to me. She was a nurse, which really surprised me that she was not informed at all about this experience, because if you go to the computer tonight when you go home and just Google menopause or male menopause, there are reams and reams and reams of information. And so she said to me, I don't understand what's happening to my husband. He's isolating. He's angry. He doesn't even want to sit anymore at the dinner table with me and the kids. I don't understand this. And having read a lot of that stuff, I said to her, has your husband experienced any significant loss in the last year or so? Like, has his father passed away? And she said, no, he's not had any. Oh, she said, Father, now that you put it that way, she said, my husband is a firefighter. And all the way through his career in our small little upstate New York village, he has been assured that when the chief retired, he would be made the fire chief. And when the chief retired, the mayor went outside the village and brought in a total stranger and put him in as the mayor. And this guy, the husband of this woman, went into a downward spiral of depression and struggle. He had lost something. He had lost a dream. He had lost a future. And of course, when I meet with people in these situations and try to give some advice, then I move on, and I never know how things turned out after I've left. But oddly enough, I was back in that same parish, and it had been almost 30 years since I was there the first time. I'm back now 30 years later, and this woman made an appointment with me, and when she came in, I didn't recognize her, because we're talking about 30 years later. And when she began, she said, you saved my marriage 30 years ago. And I said, what do you mean? She said, I came to see you, and you gave me a framework. You gave me information to read. And she said, when I began to read that information, and they gave me the profile of what a man goes through, every single one of the aspects of that profile was what my husband was going through. And she said, rather than throwing in the towel and walking away from the marriage, that I knew what he was going through from a scientific, academic point of view, helped me to cope and to work with him. And she said, he came through this, not without a lot of pain, but he came through this and became once again a wonderful father, present to our kids and present to me in our marriage. The first aspect of a good marriage is mutual respect and loyalty, and that we never use each other as public kicking balls so that everybody else enjoys how ridiculous, because they're actually gloating without wanting to recognize that maybe their own marriages are in the same place. Here is the second foundation, it seems to me, of a solid marriage, and that is that every marriage, every relationship has times of difficulty and struggle. Why? because we are not perfect people. In some cases, we're far from being perfect. And therefore, there's going to be conflict, and there's going to be struggles, and there's going to be hard times. When people down through the years have said to me, "Father, we've been married for 25 years, and we've never had an argument," I say to myself, they must be comatose. There's always going to be struggles and difficulties, because there's no such thing as a perfect marriage, like there's no such thing as a perfect priest. We are always, always in the process of being, what, recreated and recreated. And consequently, it needs to be, particularly in a marriage, that when these difficult times come, they need to be responded to with human intelligence and soft words. Nothing is ever accomplished when there is rage and there is anger. These are corrosive elements that can destroy a marriage. There have got to be soft words spoken. What distinguishes you and me from the rest of the animal kingdom? We can think. We can analyze. Those house pets, as you've heard me say before, those house pets that you left at home tonight, they are inside the front door of your house, salivating for your return. Because when you come home, those little animals, they know they're going to be given a treat because they haven't destroyed the house while you were here at church. But they did not think their way to the front door. They did not analyze. They did not say to one another, "Let's galvanize our efforts and all be at the front door when he or she comes home from church." You and I are not that way. We can think, we can have discussions, and yes, can I be honest with you? Why not? Some of these marriages and the problems that are there will never be resolved, because they are often marriages that should never have been entered into to begin with. And the only solution is divorce. I want to be honest about this tonight. I'm not encouraging people to immediately go toward direction and the direction, but there are some marriages. I can assure you that in preparing couples down through the years as a priest, particularly a young priest in university work, we put them through 6 months preparation, and they find out things about each other in those 6 months that they never shared with each other when they were courting and dating in the beginning of their relationship, where everything was magical and fantasy laden. He discovers that she's a kleptomaniac, and she's particularly inclined to steal jewelry from department stores, and she finds out that he's an arsonist and has burned 3 churches to the ground. This is hypothetical. And when you come across this during these marriage preparations, you say to this couple, "Is this the person that you want to marry and spend the rest of your life with?" And what did they say? "Oh, Father, she was a kleptomaniac before she met me. Father, he was an arsonist, but then he met me. And because of my love, she will never continue being a kleptomaniac, and he will never try to burn another building down," as if marriage is a magic wand that you wave over weirdness and it disappears. If they were that way before the marriage, they're going to be that way in the marriage. Face the truth. And sometimes the truth is so painful that the only thing that they can do is exit from this relationship. Hopefully to God, when they exit, each of them has come to the realization, what was my contribution to the breakup of this marriage? Because it's not always one side. What was my contribution to the makeup of this marriage? And if both of these people do not enter into self-analysis and come to terms with what they contributed to the breakup of their marriage, what will happen? They will plant the same seeds of destruction in secondary marriages, tertiary marriages, marriage after marriage. It's so important that we face and speak honestly, directly. We don't do anything by screaming and hollering at each other. Soft words coming from intelligent reflection and strategic planning, so that if the marriage is going to survive, it's going to survive on rock solid grounds and not on the continuation of myth and fantasy. Soft words. You'll always find this in a healthy marriage. And here is the third pillar, if you want to put it, fiscal responsibility. Because marriage at one level, it's a business deal. You heard me say the other night that my mom and dad came to this country and they courted and dated for almost 12 years before they got married. It wasn't because they were still trying to figure out whether they loved each other. It was because they wanted the marriage to be rooted in financial savings and financial security and rock solid in a responsible fiscal attitude. Nothing can endanger a marriage quicker than if one person or both people are fiscally irresponsible, running up bills on credit cards, spending money that they don't have to buy extravagant purchases. It weighs and weighs and weighs upon a marriage, and the marriage can be destroyed by fiscal irresponsibility. It's important that I mention that, because unfortunately we get caught up in the glitter of Christmas and make all kinds of extravagant purchases, and then the glitter is gone and here come the bills. And the bills cannot be paid because there is no money to pay them. I would go back to our friend Benjamin Franklin, who would warn us, don't be extravagant. Don't spend what you haven't got. Be frugal with your resources and plan and plot and fix a budget for yourself so that there's a careful use of resources and the marriage can become fiscally rooted in fiscal responsibility. And here is the fourth pillar. And I would say this, even if I wasn't standing in front of you tonight in a Capuchin habit, and therefore you would expect me to say this, I would say this even if I was in front of you and my title wasn't Father, where you would expect me to say what I'm about to say. But the fourth pillar that roots a solid marriage is that these people pray together, that there is a relationship with the God who brought them together, and that that God has got to be center in their relationship. That famous phrase from Father Peyton, the rosary priest whose cause is now up for canonization, Father Peyton always said, the family that prays together, what? Stays together. The same thing needs to be said of a marriage. They need to pray together. Now, I must go back to my brother, married to my sister-in-law for over 50 years, and I probably said this morning to the group that met with me, but I always say to my sister-in-law, she's a Southern Baptist, and I said, even though you're a Southern Baptist, even though you're not a Catholic and you're not dead, I'm going to still canonize you for living with my brother for over 50 years. And my brother said to me, well, he must have heard me mention this in some public situation, and he said to me, what do you mean Sharon and I have to pray together? She doesn't know the rosary. She doesn't know the Hail Mary. I said, what is the matter with you? People don't have to only pray by praying the rosary and reciting the Hail Mary and so forth. I said, you need to pray to pray together to God to help you in your marriage, to strengthen your... I said, if nothing else, do not get out of bed in the morning without making the sign of the cross on each other's forehead, and do not go back to bed at night without putting the sign of the cross on each other's forehead, so that you are aware that the beginning and the end of the day is in the presence of God. Praying together, having a connection to a transcendent world, so that when the struggles and the problems come, they can turn, and I'm terribly concerned, well, I'll get to that when I talk for a few minutes in the future about kids, but I do believe that it is important that married couples have a prayer together and not be uncomfortable praying together. So those four pillars, those four foundation stones, are what I have observed in the years that I have been a priest. And to just say a word or two about youngsters in the context of this, it's so terribly important that if God blesses a couple with children, that they are indeed considered the precious, precious gifts that they are. And that therefore, there needs to be strong parenting. There need to be parents who are involved and concerned about their kids. Consequently, the presence of the father in the family is absolutely essential, and the respect for the mother is absolutely essential, and that those two individuals shape and form these beautiful little creatures that God has given to them, not that they become mirror reflections of their parents, but that they come to terms with the uniqueness of each of these youngsters, and they shape them and they form them for their own journey in life. That's why the father is important and the mother is important, and I say this fully aware that that is often not the case in many situations. I gave one of these parish missions in a suburban parish outside of St. Louis years ago, and I forget what the text of the Mass was that weekend, but I made many, many references in my homily on Saturday night at the vigil Mass to marriage. The pastor took me to dinner on Saturday night, and he said to me, I'm not disagreeing with anything that you said in your homily at the 5 o'clock Mass this afternoon, but he said, Simeon, you need to realize that 82% of my parish are single parent households. He said, you can give that same homily at the 5 Masses tomorrow morning, but you're not going to be speaking into the reality of the people that are sitting in front of you. And so I respect deeply people who are raising kids, whether it's the mother or the father, struggling to raise the kids, being present to them, but to appreciate the kids and to take the time to be present to them, to shape them and to form them. Again, not to be mirror images of ourselves, but to set them on their way. That's why these eight virtues that kids need to learn how to be civil with each other. They need to experience and practice mercy and forgiveness. They need to be eager to learn and to be open to listen to other people and what they have to say to them. All of these virtues. And the other thing that I want to stress tonight is the importance of teaching the kids the value of working and develop within them a work ethic so that they have chores, that they participate in the family life, that they are a part of the unit of the family, and that therefore they should not be given everything and excused from everything when things need to be done to make the family function. Their studies, their sports, and so forth, all of these are part of what youngsters can learn from if they are taught to work hard on their studies and to work hard on their sports. Those two parts of a youngster's life can become very important teaching devices, preparing them again for the future. And I would say two more things and then I'm done. Aren't you happy? They need to be read to. You need to read to your kids. And they hopefully will become readers themselves. As I said earlier tonight, I have a background, as all the Capuchins do, in philosophy and theology, but I also have a background in literature. And I have taught literature and so forth. And when I gave kids essays to write in my classes, when I read those essays, I could tell the kids who had been read to or who had become readers, in stark contrast to the kids who had been plunked in front of a television as a cheap form of babysitting, those kids were absolutely brain dead because a box had been doing their thinking for them. The kids who had been read to and the kids who had become readers, their imaginations were rich, their imaginations were fertile, and the wonderful, wonderful insights that they could bring to writing that little essay, precisely because it was tied to reading. I think I mentioned my mom and dad came from Ireland with limited educations, but the house was filled with books. They bought a television only after my brother went to the Marines and I went to the seminary. And they did that not because they had any moral issue with the junk and the trash that's on television today. They just simply didn't think it was worthwhile. The proudest day of my little life as a youngster was the day that my mother took me down to Philadelphia Free Library, which was founded by Benjamin Franklin, so that I could have my own library card. And I continue to be a reader. One of the best gifts that someone gave me a number of years ago is a Kindle, and that's the first thing that I put into my bag when I start leaving home. If nothing else, by reading, we develop a vocabulary, and the vocabulary helps us to be articulate, helps us to have words that explain to us and to others where we're coming from. I gave a lecture several years ago at one of the major Ivy League universities in the nation. They sent a kid to pick me up at the airport to take me to the university, and getting this young student to engage me in a conversation between the airport and the university was like pulling teeth. He gave me monosyllabic answers, yeah, no. At one point, He grunted at me. And when we got to the university, I said to him, thank you for coming and getting me at the airport. And by the way, what is your major? And he said, communication. Let's go back and start all over again. So the purpose of reading is to create rich imaginations, wonderful, wonderful inventive scenarios, and to have a vocabulary through which we can speak intelligently, articulately, and meaningfully. It all is the result, and kids need to be read to. That's one of the great benefits of my education at the hands of the nuns. As a kid growing up in Catholic grade school in Philadelphia, at the end of every afternoon, before the dismissal bell rang, the nuns would say, put all of your books in your book bag, clear away the top of your desk, and put your head in your hands. And she'd read. And some of those things that she read to me years and years ago, which she read to the kids in my class, I can still remember those stories. She gave me an imagination. She gave me a rich imagination, because the nuns read to me, and so did my mom and dad. And if there's any articulateness in as I stand in front of you tonight, it's tied to the simple fact that they put a high value on reading. And thanks be to God, I am myself, even to tonight, an avid, avid reader. And here is the final thing that I think, again, I would be remiss if I didn't mention this. It's the same thing as I said about married life. The kids, we need to pray with them. We need to help them to develop a prayer life. We need to help them to develop a personal relationship with Jesus. I don't think a kid growing up, presumably, in a Christian or Catholic home, at the end of the day, last word that that kid should not hear is turn off the computer. One of the parents, or both of the parents, particularly in a Catholic home, need to go up with that youngster to his or her bedroom. And before the kid goes to sleep, they need to lead that child in the recitation of the act of contrition and the Hail Holy Queen, so that that child knows that God is with him and her. And these dark things that come in the middle of the night often into the kids' lives, that they can have consolation in knowing that God is with them and that no darkness will ever overtake them, because God's love is brighter in that bedroom than all the darkness in the world. Training kids, shaping them and forming them, teaching them to work hard, having them and correcting them when they don't live a virtuous life and we see them being mean to other kids. All those kinds of things, that's the work of parenting. And the kids turn out in the end, despite our worries and despite our anxieties, they turn out to be wonderful, wonderful individuals. All of these things are from my own observation down through the years as a priest dealing with married couples and a teacher dealing with youngsters. And I hope that what I have said here tonight about these two institutions, these two cornerstones of a virtuous life, marriage and family, that you recognize the importance of these along with me. All right, so let's just sit quietly once again, thinking about some of the things that we have reflected on, maybe not just tonight, but throughout the course of the week. Let's sit for a moment with a little bit of music playing in the background. Thank you. I want to thank you again tonight before we finish for being along with me, whether here in the church or through live stream. My hopes are always that the words that I speak, the insights that I share, somehow reach into and clarify or reinforce the beliefs that you have in your own life. That's the purpose of a parish mission, not so much to razzle and dazzle people as much as to reinforce and affirm the truth of what we believe and come back to that belief over and over again. It's been a delightful time to be with you. I'm very grateful to the priests. You have been blessed again with two gentlemen that really and truly are gifted. And it's fun. I only met Father Eric this time around, but David and I have been together a number of times. I gave the priests in the retreat here in the Archdiocese a month ago, and David was on it and said to me, "I hope I'm not going to be hearing the same thing when you come to the parish." I said, "No, David, you're not. The material that I give to priests is very different, not better, not less, but different than what I would share in a parish mission." But it's been wonderful. I also want to thank all the people that, you know, these parish missions are the effort of many, many people. But there's always one person who coordinates everything, arranges everything, contacts the people, etc. And that would be Shirley McDermott here at Our Lady of Loretto. So I'm always very grateful for her help. She and I have worked together for the three times that I've been here, and I've tried very hard to behave myself. I've tried very hard to do everything that my mother would have wanted me to do, so that David will invite me back again in the future, and hopefully we will be together for another parish mission. I don't want to finish the week without turning to the Blessed Mother. She, unfortunately, is often considered by people to be a strange goddess that we Catholics turn to and not to her son. Nothing could be further from the truth. Mary is not a goddess. She is a mother. And mothers are very persuasive people. So as Catholics, we have always turned to Mary as our mother, asking for her powerful intercession for we who are her children, and bringing to her attention all our needs, all of our hopes, and all of our dreams, as well as our disappointments. So it's only fitting that we would finish the week by thinking of her, especially in a church named after her, and on this day, a feast, Our Lady of Loretto. So we've got a triple whammy here tonight. So we turn to her, and let's pray together one of the church's most ancient prayers in honor of Mary. This is a prayer that goes all the way back to the 4th century, and it's a familiar prayer for many of us because it comes at the end of the rosary. So, if you will please rise and join with me in saying, "Hail, Holy Queen, Mother of Mercy, our life, our sweetness, and our hope. To thee do we cry, poor banished children of Eve. To thee do we send up our sighs, mourning and weeping in this valley of tears. Turn them, most gracious advocate, thine eyes of mercy towards us. And after this, our exile, show unto us the blessed fruit of thy womb, Jesus. O clement, O loving, O sweet Virgin Mary, pray for us, O Holy Mother of God. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he turn his face to you and have mercy on you. May he show you his countenance and grant you his peace. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Merry, Merry Christmas." Thank you. Okay.